సహనౌఘ్నం సహవీర్యం కరవాహై తేజస్వినాధీతమస్తు మా విద్యుషమహే. ఓం శాంతి శక్తి శాంతి.
Now yesterday when I listened to your reading and discussion in the evening, late evening, 8 o'clock, then suddenly it struck me that we should say something about what is meant by freedom in spiritual life, what is meant by reason in spiritual life. Now, coming to Swamiji's life, if we discuss perhaps yesterday and day for yesterday, you find Swamiji was the very embodiment of modern rational spirit, freedom of inquiry, not willing to believe whatever one is told. I mean, the incessant quest for independent thinking, independent experience. He was almost an agnostic, and he was influenced by the Brahma Samas, the Unitarianism, and so on. Modern inquiry was steeped in J.S. Mill, Bentham, Kant, Hegel, and Berkeley and others, who influenced the intellectuals of the 19th century. And he was so fearless, so open, so incessant in asking questions to Sri Ramakrishna. And Sri Ramakrishna liked it, that's all the more so. Sri Ramakrishna, who may not have read J.S. Mill and others, liked it all the more. In fact, he favors Narendra Swamiji. He thought Swamiji would be the right evangelist, the right messenger for him, than those conservative devotees who went to him and looked upon him as a great spiritual teacher and incarnation and accepted whatever Sri Ramakrishna told. Swamiji said that this young man is going to be his teacher. He will teach the rest. He will teach, that he said. Now, the same Vivekananda, at the end of his life, after preaching for 9 years all over the world, after creating such an impact on the intellectual landscape of the last decade of 19th century America, that Vivekananda says, whatever I have taught, whatever good things I have taught or preached, then it all belongs to him, belongs to Sri Ramakrishna. Whatever went wrong, if there was any fault, it is mine. How do you reconcile this? You can find on the one hand an agnostic youngster going to Sri Ramakrishna, the incarnation of that age, sitting at his feet, asking questions, expressing his total unwillingness at one point to accept Sri Ramakrishna's teaching of Advaita. And then asking questions, which perhaps none of the conservative Hindu devotees who went to Sri Ramakrishna ever did. Even Kesava Chandra Sen, who was a mighty intellectual of that time in the city, did not ask questions to Sri Ramakrishna the way Narendra did. But the same Vivekananda at the end of his evangelical career says, whatever little good I have done for this world, whatever wisdom or truth there was in my teachings, it all belongs to his master Sri Ramakrishna. Whatever there was something maybe not wrong, but something that was not so acceptable, whatever mistake there was, that was his. Now, what is meant by freedom? What is my intellectual inquiry? I shall try to explain this in the light of a very interesting imagery from the Mundaka Upanishad, which comes in the Atharvaveda. There's a verse which depicts the plight of pseudo-intellectuals. The pseudo-intellectual in that verse is a bird. Two birds sitting on a tree. They look alike, they behave alike, maybe they belong, They are the same birds, in fact. Two crows, I say. No, you cannot tell one from the other. They are so identical.
Dva suparna sayuja sakhaya samanam vriksham parishasva jade tayor anya piplam swadvati anasnan anyu abhichakashiti.
These are words. He continues samane vrikshe, like that he continues, but we are focusing on the first verse. A tree with two branches, one above, the other below. Two birds which look alike, the same color, you cannot tell one from the other. And practically you can't say which is, one from the other. No. So that is Sayuja Sakhaya Suparna. I mean, their wings are alike, same color. And they are brothers or sisters, depending upon whatever you call it. And they are friends. Now, they are sitting on two branches of a tree. They are alike physically, for all practical appearances, but they are totally dissimilar in another aspect. Tayoranyaha pippalam swadarti. One of them goes on eating fruits, sometimes eating bitter fruits and getting depressed. Sometimes eating sweet fruits and becoming jubilant. When the stock markets collapse, depression. When there is great accumulation of wealth, there is joy. In fact, this bird is a human being, is going through all these conflicting set of circumstances. The pendulum moving from one extreme to the other. Shankaracharya's commentary says, the bird that goes on eating fruits, sometimes bitter fruits, sometimes sweet fruits, suffering, misery, agony, and enjoying and forgetting in the joy, not real joy, the external joy, the joy that the senses bring when you, your mind and the senses of perception and senses of action focus on sensory objects of pleasure. So, moving from one end of the pendulum to the other, one extreme to the other. That bird is sitting on the branch below. The bird above, it is doing nothing. And it is just sitting quiet. It is always in a state of bliss, inner contentment. It is not affected by anything because it is not eating any kind of fruits, neither bitter fruits nor sweet fruits. Now, human beings are like that. When we have some enjoyments, we forget. And we forget that there is a higher reality, to our higher spiritual dimension to our personality. When we suffer, we knock at the doors of churches, temples and synagogues, meditation centers. But suppose we can knock at the door even without eating bitter fruits. If we can open our eyes without getting a blow on the head, that's a sign of wisdom. Now, skepticism has got this problem. Skepticism can be an intellectual trap, a trap of reason, a trap of intellectual arrogance. And the same skepticism, intellectual inquiry, reasoning power, can be a royal highway leading to the higher wisdom, which Vivekananda, yesterday's called inspiration. High inspiration never contradicts reason, it transcends reason. What a person does out of inspiration is always good for him and good for the rest of the world, because it is not contrary or it is not in conflict with reason, but it's naturally good for others. You need not have to worry about it, you don't think, you don't have to analyze what will be the result of what you're going to do if you are going to do something out of inspiration. It will be naturally good. By its very nature, it will be good for us, good for the rest of the world. That's why Swamiji in the Inspired Talks make a very radical statement. If a person claims to be inspired and talks nonsense, reject him. A very famous statement. If nonsense here means, suppose somebody says he is highly intellectual and speak things which is good for nobody, not for him or her. It's not coming out of either inspiration or reason. It is out of animal instinct. So, skepticism or intellectual inquiry can be a terrible, self-defeating, self-destructive trap. Now, what is the speciality of Vivekananda's reckless inquiry? His independent, independent inquiry, asking questions to his own master. It was not based on skepticism or self-doubt. It was a natural quest for truth. It is like a straight line. If you follow the path of intellectual inquiry, with Shraddha, what we call in sense Shraddha, the strong faith, the sincerity, with purity of mind, that inquiry will take you to a higher level of wisdom. It takes you beyond reason, it takes you to the realm of inspiration. It is like a straight line. It helps you to leave behind the realms of instinct and reason and takes you to a stage that transcends instinct and reason to the level of higher wisdom, which is called inspiration. You get inspired in spite of yourself. When you are inspired, whatever you do happens to be good for you and good for the world, good for the whole universe. That's a test of it. So, independent inquiry, which is accompanied by purity of mind, sincerity of mind, not skeptical, self-destructive, self-defeating, intellectual arrogance or track, but rather pure, sincere search for truth, is like a straight line. It begins with doubts, it goes through a process of getting knowledge from a teacher or from a scripture, and finally it takes you beyond all these lower levels to the highest spiritual wisdom. That's what happened to Swami Vivekananda. Swami Vivekananda, who was an independent seeker of truth, who asked questions to his own master, finally told the world that whatever he taught, whatever he learned, it all came from his master, Sri Ramakrishna. Whatever there was, perhaps something not so desirable, it was his own. That is the humility of Vivekananda. Then there is the other kind of intellectual inquiry, which I referred to earlier. That is the condition of this bird which goes on eating bitter fruits and again eating sweet fruits, never moving to the higher branch where his friend, the other bird, is sitting. The other bird is the symbol of an enlightened, a spiritually accomplished, enlightened seeker. We call in the Bhasha Ifa Ishara, Tayor Anyapi Palam Swadat. Anasnan means the bird who is not eating anything, who is sitting quiet, serene, calm, on the higher branch. It is always in a state of inner contentment, inner bliss, inner spiritual self-realization. So, if intellectual inquiry becomes a trap, it's like a cycle, a circle. It goes on rotating. It never takes you out of the wheel, out of the cycle. Because a cycle has no beginning, no end. It doesn't begin anywhere, you know. And it doesn't anywhere. It does, if you go on rotating along a wheel, there is no way to come out of it. But if you are going through a straight line, at one point the line will come to an end. And you transcend the line. So independent inquiry, intellectual inquiry, without skepticism or self-doubt, without intellectual arrogance, but built on the foundations of sincerity, purity, and real earnest thirst for truth. It is like a straight line. At the end of the line, you are beyond it. You reach the highest wisdom. The other inquiry is like a trap, a cycle. You go on rotating, there is no way to come out of it. That's why sometimes we ask a question and then we get an answer. Apparently we are satisfied. After 5 days we ask the same question because we have not taken seriously what we were asking. So we did not take seriously what answer we got. So practically it goes on. So it becomes, and then we have a strong feeling, I'm mighty big intellectual. Not willing to believe the superstitious things, nothing like that. So that is the basic difference between true freedom and its opposite. In a way, moving around in a cycle is a spiritual slavery. Because we are practically tied to the cycle, the wheel. We don't come out of it. It doesn't help you to come out of it. But moving along a straight line of true spiritual inquiry, it takes you beyond beyond doubt, beyond contradiction. It takes you beyond instinct and beyond reason. It takes us to the realm of inspiration. That is the real message of this image. Dva suparna savija sakhaya samanam vrikshan parishusujati. In the coming back to this imagery, there are a few very interesting aspects in this imagery. First, you should remember the birds look alike. So, the bird that is going on eating sweet and bitter fruits, suffering and enjoying, human beings. The bird sitting above, calm and quiet, is God. So, we are one with God. We are not two different entities. The difference between a human being and God is a difference in degree of manifestation of the divine. That's Vivekananda makes a very interesting statement. The difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees and not of kind. Buddha literally in Sanskrit means the enlightened one. Amoeba is a very primitive creature where the divine spark is manifesting in a very low degree. So, as we evolve, we become divine. That's what is meant by saying, defining religion as a manifestation of divinity already in man. When the divinity manifests, you become a Buddha. When it is not manifesting at all, or manifesting in a very low degree, you are an amoeba, or you are maybe a Genghis Khan, an Attila. That's all. That's the basic difference. Now, in the Bhagavata Purana, which is really a commentary on Vedantic way of life, Vedantic principles, there are very few interesting episodes which bring out this idea. And one of them is the life of Vyasa, the author of Bhagavata himself. He's a classic. So this Vyasa was the greatest scholar and philosopher and saint of his age. He was the one who edited the Vedas into 4 categories, Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda and Atharveda, and taught each of them to one of his 4 disciples, Vaila, Jaimini, Vaishambhayana and Sumantu, like that. And he was the one who wrote the important law books of those days. Vyasa Smriti is the oldest one, older than Manusmriti. And he wrote the dialectical work like Brahma Sutras. And he wrote 18 huge grand mythological books, Puranas, and 18 secondary Puranas, 36 huge mythological books, and the Mahabharata, more than 100,000 verses. He's the author of Gita, after all, put in words, so many words, The teachings of Sri Krishna was put in so many words by Vyasa. Was not an ordinary person. The most learned man of his time. The most accomplished sage and philosopher of his schools. This Vyasa was depressed. But instead of taking medicine, you know what he did? He went and sat on the bank of river Saraswati in the evening. After his usual meditation, which he did every morning and evening, he was sitting completely depressed. Now, there was nothing for him to achieve in this world. He had enough of everything. He was the grand patriarch of the community of saints and sages and philosophers of that age. So, what was this man after all? What was he supposed to be worried about? Nothing. But then he felt a kind of inner vacuum, emptiness. Something is lacking, something is going wrong. And then at that time, another sage appeared. He was wandering in that area. He happened to meet Vyasa. So it was Narada. So Narada asked this Vyasa, "You are such an accomplished person. What is wrong with you? You look so depressed, so unhappy. What's going wrong in your mind?" Vyasa said, "I don't know. I have everything. We put in modern language, you can think of it, a great trillionaire, captain of industry, maybe a big politician. Everything perfectly all right. It's difficult for such a person to be unhappy. It's very difficult to be happy. But for this person, very difficult to be unhappy because everything was all right for him. But he was the unhappiest and most depressed person of his life. So Narada told him, I know what is wrong with you. You wrote all these big mighty volumes depicting what we should do, how we should conduct ourselves. All of his books are books on human conduct, dharma. Dharma is nothing but the science of human conduct. Virtues, values that we must practice in our life to be able to enjoy artha and karma properly. Means you should be able to enjoy life in this world. For that you need an order, a discipline, all these things. So a constitution, everything. Vyasa has written all this. But you never transcended that realm of intellectual self-satisfaction. Still Vyasa was like a bird that was eating sweet fruits and bitter fruits. You may be the most accomplished intellectual, roaring like a lion about his intellectual freedom. You may be the unhappiest, most depressed person in your private chamber. You may be the most eloquent politician, eloquent exponent of freedom and values and so on. But in your own private chamber of your own mind, fully depressed, unhappy. That can be seen, sometimes visible in the face of many people. Now, Vyasa, unfortunately, was in that situation. So Narada told him, "You are a wonderful intellectual. You are a great philosopher. You have led a pure life." But Vyasa was a great man. So such a person felt the need for a higher value. Most people don't feel it. They are happy eating bitter fruits and sweet fruits and moving along the wheel, along this cycle, never coming out of it. Very often we feel perfectly satisfied living within the little intellectual trap, the little shell, and we think we are mighty great. Because we can ask questions. But going back to your own room, we become unhappy. Something going. Again, next day, again, we continue this. The cycle never ends because it never begins. Straight line begins and it ends somewhere. So, in this case, in this intellectual trap, Vyasa was caught. So, Narada tells you, "Look here. Now you have to go beyond this trap. You have to expound some higher spiritual values. So you write a book that be a great blessing to the whole humanity, expounding the life and teachings of Lord Krishna, the incarnation of the age. His divine play. Because the moment you come out to the philosophical track and you enter spiritual life, suddenly the dark chambers of our mind suddenly will get lighted. That's what really happens. The moment you leave that behind and start, if you start expounding the spiritual teachings, the spiritual life, what we call the Leela, the great divine play of Lord Krishna, that effort, that work of writing this great spiritual work will purify your mind and it will remove all the darkness from the inner chambers of your mind. And Vyasa started writing this book. That's known as the Bhagavad Purana. Yesterday we gave a long discussion of Parikshit's curse and how this great emperor, instead of getting angry or depressed, became wiser when he got a blow. And because a wise person understands, well, there is something wrong which made me go through this experience. So I must remove the cause. Those who are not wise won't understand. They look at the surface and they don't look beneath the surface. So as I said, so you can imagine the great curse that fell upon him made him ask the most profound question of Vedanta way of life. Atha prichami samsiddhin yoginam paramam gurum purusha seha yakkaryam vayamanasya sarvata. As I said, what should a dying man do? And in answer to this, Shuka, Vyasa's own son, expounds the Bhagavata Purana, which we got it and explained yesterday. So that's how Vyasa started writing this great book. Now, how Vyasa expounds these ideas? That's what we are going to discuss now. There are many interesting episodes in this work. Many. Some of them deal with animals. Some of them deal with saints and kings. Say, one example is there. Some of them deal with spiritual seekers. The story of Ajamila. Ajamila was a person actually born in a pious family. As a child, he was brought up as a God-fearing boy. He was trained in religious rituals. He went to temple every day. He prayed every day. And he led a pious life. But in course of his lifetime, as he slowly evolved from boyhood to youth, he had a terrible fall. He fell into bad company. And he became actually a demon, an evil person. So you can imagine the influence of company, the influence of ideas. And that's why Swami Yatheswarananda, in his meditation and spiritual practice, writes about the need for a mental filtering mechanism. You should have an automatic filtering mechanism within. So whenever negative ideas coming from people with negative mindset, negative character, pessimistic and skeptical, we must have this filtering mechanism ready to filter out the wrong ideas, the negative ideas that come from outside. So, but this man, unfortunately, did not have this. He fell into bad company and became a very evil person. He ill-treated his parents. I won't go into those details. He ill-treated all good people. He did all that he should not have done, and did the thing that he should have done. So there's nothing more to be said about him. He did not do anything that he should have done, and he did everything that he should never have done. Now, nothing more to be said about him. Now, he was approaching the end of his life. He had become a profligate, everything. Now, there was nobody to help him. He had become completely depressed. Now, when we lead an evil life, at the end, what happens, you know, when we have nothing to remember that will console our mind, it becomes a terrible problem. You go to any of these old age homes, daycare homes, or discuss with the people working in the hospice, they will tell you the reality. That's why, you know, yesterday we quoted the Upanishad mantra, day before yesterday perhaps, Kritam Smara means a dying man is pleading to his own mind, oh mind, please remember all the good deeds, all the good thoughts that I have gone through. Please don't remember anything that's bad. So a dying man is miserably pleading to his own mind to remember, to recollect, to go back to the good deeds, good thoughts that mind had gone through. Now, Ajamila did not have a huge stock of good deeds to his credit. So, his mind was naturally going to all the evil things he had done. So, you can imagine his condition. But, by twist of destiny, there was a silver line in his life. His son's name was Narayana. Narayana is an adjective of God. Narayanam Ayanam means the ultimate destination, the ultimate goal of human life. Either the shelter, the protector, the destination, the supreme goal of human existence, Narayana. It is also the name of Lord Vishnu, name of God, a synonym of God in the Vaishnava tradition, Hindu religious tradition. So this man, in his total helplessness, is trying to think of good thoughts, but nothing will come to the mind because there is nothing good that he had done in his life. So he felt so miserable. So out of sheer helplessness, he calls out to his son, whose name was Narayana. But actually, you know, incidentally, as I said, the Narayana is the name of God also. So listening to this, his son was about to come to him, but some others also came to him. The angels of Lord Narayana, God, also came to him. Before that, the mythological story has got a deep spiritual content. That's what we are focusing on. At the end of his life, there were messengers coming from hell to take him straight there. So they have already assembled, trying to tie him and maybe trying to ill-treat him. At that moment, he was frightened, he was scared, he felt miserable. So he called out to his son, whose name was Narayana, which was incidentally the name of God. So when he uttered this name Narayana, suddenly, you know what happened? His mind went back to his early days. As a young boy, he was brought up as a God-fearing boy. And he used to utter the sacred name of Narayana. He didn't mean that, because his mind had become so polluted by bad life that he could not remember the mantra that he was uttering during his early days. But the mantra, the sacred name, happened to be Narayana, which is the name of his son. So as he called out his son, his mind suddenly, for a split second, went back to the days when he was, with great devotion, uttering the sacred name of Narayana. So at that time, the angels came from God to take him there. So there's a dialogue, conversation between the messengers of hell and the messengers of God. And the messengers of God tell the other person, you have no right, you have no claim on this person. He has uttered the name of God, so he is ours. That's the burden of this dialogue. Now what it means is this. If a person has done even a little bit of spiritual, if he has achieved a little bit of spiritual merit by doing good deeds, going through good thoughts, that will become a capital. And if we can remember that, that takes us away from bondage and also from spiritual dictation. Now, Vyasa incorporates all these stories just to focus the greatness of taking the holy name of God. And Vyasa says it should be done with total surrender. We can ask questions, but when we do something, it should be done with perfect concentration and sattva. So Ajamila's story is a very interesting story. There is an equally interesting story, which actually is a story of an elephant. That's an interesting story. And there was a king. He was a very pious person. And once it so happened that he did not properly honor some spiritual personalities, he, perhaps by mistake or so, he omitted something. He did not get up and respect and receive some saintly persons who came to him. Actually, nothing wrong in it, but the point is, when we do something that hurts saintly personalities, that act creates a shadow and it chases, it will follow us wherever we go. That's why sometimes we do a lot of good things, but it doesn't connect, it doesn't click. Because some shadow, dark shadow, is a result of some misdeeds in the past, is following us. It can be neutralized only through good deeds. So something happened to this king. His name was Indradyumna. He was a king, a pious king. So as a result of this flaw, this mistake, he was born as an elephant. And this elephant wandered, he became a very powerful elephant. He was the leader of the herd of elephants. He moved all over the forest, and one day it enters a lake to drink water because it was thirsty. Then suddenly it so happened that a huge crocodile caught it by its feet and tried to drag it to water. Now if the elephant enters water, the crocodile will kill the elephant. The elephant tried to drag the crocodile out of water, then it could crush it. So it depends upon the location of the battle. So if elephant is dragged into the water, it will die. The crocodile is dragged into the land, it will die. The crocodile will die. In the process, a long fight took place. At the end of it, the elephant was being slowly dragged into the depths of water. Its friends, its family members tried to protect it, but there was no hope. At that time, the elephant suddenly remembered his previous life, when the elephant was a king, a pious king. He had done a lot of good meritorious deeds, had meditated upon God, has done a lot of spiritual practices. So that memory suddenly flashed in his mind. And immediately the elephant remembered the sacred mantra it used to utter in his previous life as the pious king. And uttering that mantra, it took a lotus from the lake where the fighting was going on and mentally offered to the Lord. So the story Vyasa says, the Lord appeared and saved by killing the crocodile. Like that. Now you can imagine how this great philosopher wrote all these stories. This Vyasa was the one who wrote the most profound metaphysical works. He was the one who edited the Upanishads. He was the greatest philosopher of his times. And he was a rational thinker. But the same Vyasa suddenly reaches another dimension of his spiritual personality. Leaving all the mighty philosophical dialectics behind, he focuses on the simple art of devotion. If one can mentally offer oneself to the Lord, that will take you beyond intellectual skepticism. Because one important point that Vyasa makes clear in all these episodes is that we never live at the intellectual level. Even the most profound intellectual lives only at mental level. Often, you know, why sometimes people fail, people fall in spiritual life? There's a deviation. Whatever we pursue at the intellectual level, we imagine we have already reached it mentally. But mind is far below, far behind. The intellect may read wonderful philosophical books, Mandrika Karita, Ashtavakra Samhita, God is present everywhere, God is present with me, there's nothing more for me to do. Such ideas could come because often from the intellectual perspective, we may look upon spirituality as a doctrine, which is a terrible mistake. Spirituality is not a doctrine, it is not the philosophy, it is a matter of experience. And the experience takes place at the mental level, not intellectual level. So, all spiritual practices are meant like prayer, meditation, selfless service, contemplation, discussion of spiritual topics, discussion between friends, discussion between fellow spiritual seekers, retreats. All these are meant to take us beyond the intellect, or rather, to enable us to bring to mental level what we understand at the intellectual level. Because there's a wide gap between where we stand intellectually and where we stand mentally. We act, we think, we behave, we live at the mental level, not intellectual level. Intellectual level is very scanty. But then intellect plays a very important role in helping us in our spiritual life. Intellect enables us to grasp and understand and contemplate on great spiritual ideas. After that, mentally when we practice, it could be any of the four yogas, karma yoga, bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, any yoga. Then what happens, you know, the gap between intellect and mind is closed. So what we intellectually pursue is brought to the level of mind, then it becomes ours, then it becomes our experience. For that, Vyasa in this book brings all these wonderful spiritual truths in a very harmonious way. And he says, in one of the most famous part of his classical work is this. Once, it deals with the dialogue. You already discussed many of the dialogues earlier. It's a dialogue between a king and a group of saints, nine saints. It comes for those of you who are interested, you can read the Bhagavata text. It is divided into 12 skandhas, 12 books. It appears in the 11th book, 11th skandha, second chapter onwards. So there's a long dialogue between a king and emperor, Nimi, that is the name, and nine sages. Once these nine sages happened to visit the emperor in his palace. Kavir Kavir Andariksha Prabuddha Pipalayana Avi Khotroda Samasat Parabhajana Kavihi Hari Andariksha Prabuddha Pipalayana Avi Khotra. These are all names of these saints. And Nimi is the name of the king. So they come and visit the king in his palace. So in those days, it's a common practice. Whenever great saints and sages visited you in your home, if you are an ordinary citizen, or in your palace, if you are a king or emperor, you should put questions to them. Not to test them whether they know what we know or not, but rather to enrich your wisdom. So in this case, the king was himself a learned person, a wise man. He puts nine questions. Each question to each one of these nine saints. He's got Nava Yogi, means nine yogis, nine wise men, or nine saints, or sages. Nimi Nava Yogi Sambhata means a dialogue between the king Nimi and nine sages. He asked many questions, what we should do in this age to become spiritually oriented, to achieve spiritual realization, what we should not do, whom we should associate with, whom we should not associate with, how to judge whether your association with a person or an idea will be a blessing or a curse to you. So, and this Kavi says, one of the earlier one says, if an idea creates doubt in your mind, weakens in your conviction of higher spiritual pursuit, don't accept it. And keep a little distance away from those from whom these ideas flow into your mind. In the course of this dialogue, the king asks one very important question. Who is the greatest devotee, the ideal spiritual man or woman in this world? In answer to this question, Antariksha, the third of the nine sages, answers. It is given in three verses. In a descending order, Antariksha gives a graphic picture of evolution of spiritual life. The three verses are this: Sarva Bhudeshu Yapashit Bhagavad Bhavam Atmanaha Bhudani Bhagavadi Atmani Esha Bhagavadottamaha Ishwari Tadadineshu Bali Sheshu Dishatsucha Prema Maitri Kruba Ubeksha Yak Karodi Mathimaha Archaya Mevahari Pujamsa Shuddhi Ikhde Nachatad Bhakteshu Tanyeshu Yak Karodi Saprakta. These are three verses. I should explain this. The first verse says, who is the highest devotee? The highest. In a way, the highest devotee is also a person who has reached the highest level of advaitic or non-dualistic experience. Because jnanam, the path of knowledge and the path of devotion, the path of intellectual wisdom or knowledge, or jnanam is called, or advaita, and the path of devotion are different as means, but when you reach the goal, they are the same. Shankaracharya himself says, in one of his verses, maicha ninnayogena bhaktira vibhijarini vivikta desha savyettum anabhijjana samsadhi. While depicting, by defining the purest and highest devotion, Shankaracharya says, Sachatnyanam, that highest devotion is the highest Advaitic experience itself. That's, you find it in the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, you find the gospel. No, the point is, the teacher gives a beautiful graphic picture of the highest spiritual man. A man of the highest spiritual wisdom. Sarva Bhudeshu Yapashet Bhagavad Bhavam Atmanaha. The one who sees the presence of God in everything. Not only in the human beings, but in all living beings, everywhere. The one who sees, experiences, not just believes in, but rather experiences the presence of the Lord, the presence of God in everything in this world. And also the presence of everything, the whole creation in God. That person is the highest devotee. This means it is not a person who goes to a temple or a church or any place of worship regularly, who reads a sacred book in a very, very methodical, regular way. He may be, but that alone will not make him or her the highest devotee. That's the meaning. The highest devotee may go to a temple or a church every day, but just because a person goes to a place of worship or follows a set of mechanical rituals, that alone will not make him or her the highest devotee of God. So what is the fundamental criterion to judge whether a person belongs to the highest category of spiritual achievement? It is this: he or she should be able to see the presence of Lord in everyone and the presence of all in God. So I remember, you know, whenever we state this idea, sometimes people ask the question, what about people who are so undesirable? You see, The next verse says you have to use discrimination when dealing with people. That's the next verse says. This is the state of the highest devotee. But you cannot reach this stage all of a sudden. Just because you read this book, you should not imagine that we have reached there, that we've been troubled. Often, you know, Buddha was a great man. And as Buddha was traveling, he met an evil demon, Angulimala, whose hobby was to cut people into pieces, take away all their wealth, and cut out all the fingers and make a garland of it and wear it on his neck. That was his hobby. So he thought, when he saw Buddha, he thought, well, he is going to get another, at least one dozen fresh supply of fingers, which he can use for preparing this garland, because he was getting a regular supply, because a murderer and a brutal robber. So he saw Buddha coming there. Many people want Buddha, don't go that way. This big evil man is living there. Buddha said, it's all right, no problem. So Buddha was walking, and this fellow was trying to chase him, running after him. Buddha slowly walked. Angulimala, this evil man, could not catch up with him. He felt so angry. And he was started shouting and cursing Buddha. He was badly in need of a fresh supply of fingers to make this. Anguli means these fingers. So Buddha stopped and looked back. So when Angulimala looked at Buddha, suddenly he found, this man doesn't hate me. Because Buddha saw the presence of God in Angulimala also. For Buddha, it was not a doctrine or a philosophy in which he believed that would make it. For him it was a matter of experience. And he fell at his feet, and Angulimala became a great Buddhist bhikshu. That's the story. But suppose people reading the story tries this experiment, this will be in deep trouble. So, in fact, to help them, the next verse says, before you reach this day, you should not behave like this. So, Ishwari tadadhineshu balisheshu disatsucha prema maitri krupa ubeksha yak karodi sammadhyama. Then there is a mid-level devotee who has not reached the highest level of seeing God everywhere and seeing all in God. So Vyasa says, see what a... That's Vyasa actually built a ladder for you to climb slowly to the highest level. That was the great work he did. So Vyasa says, Vyasa speaking through this great saint, Antariksha, of course. He says, have devotion to God and be friendly with fellow devotees, fellow spiritual seekers, because if you are friendly with fellow spiritual seekers, you can discuss spiritual topics with them that will be mutually enriching and will be helpful. So whenever we meet with fellow spiritual seekers, we must discuss some topics that take us beyond the world of senses. It need not necessarily be spirituality, but at least some philosophic higher topics. And slowly we should discuss spirituality. Yes. So Vyasa says, have devotion to God, Ishwari tadhineshu. Then be friendly with other devotees of God. Then there are people who may not have had any occasion to get acquainted with spiritual ideas. But they would like to know, but they didn't get a chance. They are ignorant, somewhat primitive, but they are sincere souls. You should have sympathy for them. Third category. Then there are some people, if you associate with them, they will tell you, oh, there is nothing in all this, all absolute rubbish. They may listen to all these things, but behind them, oh, this is all nothing. Everything, all the effect of listening to spiritual topic, everything gone. Because it's like pouring a lot of water on the pot and put upside down. So Vyasa says, Upeksha, keep a long distance from them. Ishwari tadadhineshu balisheshu disascha prema maitri krupa upeksha. devotion to God, friendly feeling towards fellow spiritual devotees, sympathy for those who want to know about God, and keeping long distance, upeksha, total indifference towards those whose association or ideas emanating from whom can pollute your own spiritual life. Very practical method. Then Vyasa comes down to the lowest category. There are many who try to turn to spiritual life, but they manufacture two compartments. One compartment, secular life, another compartment, spiritual life. So, like a military officer or in military barracks, they may follow certain mechanical rituals. Nothing wrong in it. Mechanical rituals like going to kindergarten or primary school. You have to begin somewhere. But if a child thinks that kindergarten is the highest university in the world, then he is heading for trouble. Similarly, some people are there. There are some people who start with mechanical devotional life habits, but then they don't go one inch beyond that. So, that's a problem. So, Vyasa says, there are those who worship God and hate everyone else. Great devotion to God on the one hand, and great hatred and hostility towards the whole creation. Now Vyasa says that they are the most primitive because they block their own spiritual progress. So Vyasa's recommendation is we must start somewhere, but we should not imagine or interpret the beginning stage as the last and highest stage. We must keep moving forward. We have to start with books, belief systems and rituals, and slowly we must establish a link between what we do in the morning and evening, regular spiritual practices. Along with that, we must establish a link to our day-to-day life activities. And finally, we must try to merge the secular with the spiritual so that the whole world becomes a temple, whole life can be spiritualized. So in Vyasa's classic, you find prescriptions and lessons for spiritual seekers of all categories. So it is itself a great spiritual university that Vyasa actually created by writing this classic Bhagavata. It all came because he was worried. We got a great man, Buddha the prophet, because he was worried. He was not worried about himself. He was worried about the problems of other people. So also Vyasa. You find in the long discussion between Vyasa and Narada, you find the beginning of Bhagavata Purana. Now we'll have interaction for 30 minutes. Thank you. You can ask questions based on today's lessons.
So the most obvious thing, probably superficial, is that even in the Bhagavata, fanaticism is recognized. Fanaticism is recognized.
The possibility of fanaticism.
In the third recommendation.
Yeah, possibility. And how to go beyond it. The medicine also is prescribed. So it's all there are fanatics. Now if we recognize the mechanical practices and if we recognize the need for them without looking upon them as the final goal, then there will be no fanaticism. The problem arises because sometimes we interpret early stage, the kindergarten of spiritual life, as the highest level of spiritual education. Then only problem arises. That's what Vyasa says, implies this time.
What is Buddhist text?
Pardon?
Text. What text? What text you are referring to there?
Maharaj, Bhagavata Purana, what the last one comes in the 11th skandha, Ekadasa skandha, second chapter. The dialogue between Andariksha and there, these three verses come.
No, the beginning
of that. Oh, in the retreat. Yeah, that the central theme is Vedanti, way of life. So we took a lesson from Upanishads and scriptures in general. First I tried to give a short description of Vedic way of life, first 1 or 2, 3 days, and then Vedanti from Upanishads and steps. Gita. There is no single text that you have this time.
When was this penned down? When was Bhagavata Purana and when was Mahabharata?
Yeah.
When were the Brahma Sutras penned down by Radharayana Vyasa?
Yeah, you know, Bhagavata must have existed in some form much earlier, but it took its present literary form around 7th century AD. It became popular only after some centuries. So the general consensus among scholars is that the work must have originated much earlier, but it took its present form much later. Very often, many of these works became popular as oral tradition. Yes. Vedas, unlike Bhagavata, Vedas used to be studied and taught orally and memorized and ritually chanted, recited every day in so many families and traditions. So they became well known much earlier. The Bhagavata as a text became so popular as it is now only much later. So the original form must have taken come into existence much earlier. But the present literary form belongs to 7th or maybe 8th century AD.
Because you mentioned that Vyasa taught Jaimini, but
that's true. So there are views that there are not just single Vyasa. But Vyasa was the originator of the Bhagavata, maybe not the compiler of the present literary form. That's the thing. Because Bhagavata stories prevailed much earlier. The Vyasa who edited Vedas may be the one who originally conceived the whole episode, but the present literary form must be attributed to some other scholar. Because it's a very modern text, you know. In Sanskrit tradition, the earlier text used to be simple, the later they literary classics and tend to be more complicated. They have much more complex literary structure. That's the meter and prosody, all the metrical forms are a little more complicated in later parts. He gives a description of different levels of spiritual evolution, which everyone can follow. Different levels. So it's a universal.
So this is the same as the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th verses in the Gita in descending order for devotion.
No, that's different, you know. That in the Bhagavad Gita Bhakti Yoga, 8 to 11th verses, the 12th chapter from 8 to 11, if total there are. Four verses. The four levels of spiritual progress at the individual sadhana. But this is more common. This is much more profound and philosophical, Bhagavata. Yes. See, Mayyeva mana tatsva mayi buddhin nivesiya nivasishyasi mayyeva adha udhanna samchere. 8th verse. Maybe it could be interpreted as similar to this, but this Bhagavata verse is much more profound. Because it comes in the form of a dialogue between a king and a sage. So the sage gives a direct reply to the question, who is the highest devotee? In the sense, who is the most accomplished spiritual person? How do we know him? How we judge him? So he says the highest devotee is one who sees no difference in the whole creation, who sees God everywhere and who sees all in God. So in a way it is a experience of Advaitic, non-dualistic experience it is. But that's the highest devotion. You find whenever in all traditions, whenever great spiritual seekers leave behind the mechanical, the theological, the philosophical realms and the mystical level, immediately you find they enter this higher experience. Mysticism in religion is different from mysticism in literature. Mysticism in religious life, in spiritual life, is nothing but the intimate communion with the reality and the vision of unity of existence, vision of the oneness of existence, the presence of God everywhere and the presence of everything in God. That's the beginning of higher mysticism even in Catholic tradition. Of course, there is always the problem of language, you know, always Satan looming large in front of you. Otherwise, you find the same higher spiritual transcendental experience, you know, mystics. You can directly see and experience God without depending upon a priest or a temple or a clergy or any particular book. God can be approached directly, hotline. That is the speciality of mysticism in spiritual life, be different from mysticism in literature and philosophy.
You know, Swami, your explanation of the story of Ajamala, is that his name?
Ajamila. Yes.
This, that did help, because this story has always troubled me, because it's as though his intention didn't matter. He could say the name Narayana, but he didn't mean God, he meant his son. And it's as though the intention of what you do doesn't matter. You could do it rotely.
But that's because his mind suddenly went back beyond the name of his son, but to the sacred mantra or something. That's because during his early phase of life, he had practiced deep spiritual meditation. So that won't be lost. In later life, he had a deviation. That's true. Mm-hmm. But the early practices would not be completely lost. Sometimes whatever little you practice during the early phase of your life comes to your desk at one point. It won't be lost.
So it's as though his intention then did, like maybe he initially meant his son, but then he went back to that.
Naturally his mind went back. But that's because of the intensity with which you must have practiced as a young boy. That happens. If you have prayed once sincerely, a few times you have done, you know, then it creates, register a strong impression in the mind. It goes much deeper than any other kind of superficial practices. It is the intensity of practice that creates a strong mark in the mind. This later you remember. We always remember something if we have done that with a strong intensity. It is the intensity that creates a strong influence, strong impression in the mind. Yes, sir.
So it was not the fact that he spoke a holy name, but it was the fact that he spoke his mantra.
His mind went back to that.
But it was not just the holy name, it was really his mantra spoke.
Yes, but mantra, he must have practiced this mantra with great concentration and meditation and intense contemplation. So it created a strong impression in his mind, which lay very deep at the lower layer of his mind, subconscious mind. So later, in total helplessness, he called his son to begin with. And immediately, maybe along with that, suddenly, oh, this is the mantra which I was after. Why? Because it has left a strong mark in the subconscious level. So suddenly that came to the surface. That pushed aside all the other undesirable impressions that we must have that gathered in the top layers of his mentally like a lake, you know. This came from the bottom and it projected itself. Suddenly, yes.
So that is the purpose of the mantra, to displace all these other thoughts.
Yes, that could be helpful depending upon the intensity with which we have practiced. It happens in our life also. Sometimes if suddenly a strong positive thought current, an impulse comes to the surface and starts influencing our actions and thought currents, it's because it is laying the deeper layers of the mental lake. We must have gathered during previous life or some other lives in the distant past. Suddenly it comes to the surface when an external circumstance is conducive, so it deconnects. The mind is like a lake with different layers of impressions and vrittis and vasanas and samskaras. Some of them lay very strong currents, impressions may lay at the bottom level. They may come to the surface because you are totally helpless. And also it is stated, at the time of death, when your mind cannot play games, in literally speaking, it is said, that's one view, at the time of death, the totality of all your impressions may come to the surface. The strongest of them will come to the surface. See, in normal life, you may be able to smile even when you have a terrible hatred against your friend. Or you have bitter stomach pain, you will be able to smile. But you have to do that. A business executive, salesman, anybody. But at the time of death, whatever natural impressions are there within, they come to the surface, the forefront. Because mind becomes weakened, senses become weakened. That's what really happens. You find in the interpretation of the Ishavasya Upanishad, which I mentioned the other day, that's why Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasa. You find the devotee in Ishavasya Upanishad, towards the end of the mantra, the Upanishad, is addressing his deity, to whom he was praying and whom he was meditating upon for a long time. And now he prays to him. Please save me, please show me your real nature. And then he pleads to his own mind. Mind, please remember, Kritam Smara, Kritam Smara, please remember all the good deeds you have done. Because all the good deeds will automatically throw up good samskaras, which will console him. That's the prayer in the Ishavasya, which we call it depressed.
Swamiji, so it sounds like having strong, good samskaras is very important, the intensity of the spiritual practice. And I guess my question is, what makes for intensity of spiritual practice? So is it strong intellectual concentration or strong, you know, yearning, or what is the intensity that you're using when you're talking about intense spiritual practice?
Well, when we concentrate on something intensely, we become one with it, with that idea. Whatever we concentrate on with great intensity, we become one with it. There is a degree of identifying with what we concentrate upon. As for the registration of the impression, I can give an example. See, suppose you're walking in the street, when you walk in the street, you see different things on the street, like stones, pebbles, maybe travelers and cars and vehicles and so on. You don't take notice of them. So, after reaching your place, you may not remember how many vehicles, how many people you saw in the street, or stones, or lampposts. You don't remember them because you did not take any special notice of any of them. But suppose you are chased by a dog, for example. God forbid it ever happens. But suppose it happens, and you run, and you hurt yourself, maybe your finger. You don't forget the way that dog, at least for some days. And you don't forget that street where it happened. Why? Because that incident has registered a strong impression in your mind. To give another example, as I said earlier, when you walk in the street, you meet many things, you see many things lying in the street, you don't take any notice of them. But suppose you have lost your passport or identity card. And you know you are walking in that street, so it should be lying somewhere. You must have fallen from your pocket, so you know it should be. And as you walk in the street, you suddenly find your identity ID card lying, passport lying. You have no doubt whether it's my passport or not. You pick it up. But suppose you don't know. Suppose you are walking in the street, you see similar papers, you don't remember them. So when you are intensely searching for your passport, what happens, you know? All other impressions and vrittis, as they call, are pushed away, pushed out of your mind. Your mind is fully focused on that particular object that you are trying to retrieve, that you are searching. Everything else is pushed back, out of the mind. Your mind itself takes the form of that. That's why vrittisarupyam idaratra, one of the Patanjali Sutra, vrittisarupyam idaratra. If we do not practice yoga, chitta vritti nirodha, what happens? Our mind assumes the form of whatever impressions we have in our mind. In your whole mind, you are the picture of the ID card. So when you see lying there, you pick it up. So what happens, you know? Depending upon the intensity of what we are looking for, or experiences we have, the impression is created, strong impression. Certain impressions you never forget. That's why, you know, in hypnotism and also in regression, when patients are taken back to the memory formation years, frequently psychiatrists are able to cure many problems by giving a logical explanation of some of the incidents that must have taken place in your childhood, which may be bothering you. So when he's given a rational explanation, they are able to cure many of the psychological conflicts and many of the problems. Even some schizophrenic problems could be solved like that, through regression. So why these memories bother and they re-emerge in the form of conflicts? Conflicts are directly related to regressed or maybe unwelcome thought currents, what Patanjali calls vrittis or impressions, that come to the surface because they are linked to a very unfortunate episode and that has left a strong mark in the chitta mind. So the vritti is strong, so it comes to the surface, it creates conflict. Obsession, for example, obsessive psychosis is a serious problem. Obsession is directly linked to a strong impression left in the mental lake. So often, through explanation, counseling, obsession can be reduced.
The examples you gave were all cases of a kind of a pain or
pleasant.
Bring about that intensity in spiritual practice.
Yes, yes.
How would you bring that about unless you...
Well, I will come to that. Now, one way to do is, we must keep our mind constantly fed. Feed your mind constantly with spiritual food. Reading is one, discussion is one, attending prayer, lectures is one, meditating, prayer, all this. So we need not worry about the negative side, the problems. Actually, worrying about problems can intensify problems in spiritual life. We should forget that chapter behind. Leave it behind. And focus exclusively on the positive dimension, as you said. So what we must do, by all means, try to divert our mind into creative, useful channels, feeding the mind with positive, good, healthy, spiritual food. For that, and it is said that, you know, the five senses of perception, like eyes, ears, sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, all of them, together or independently, they bring food to your mind. All food may not be healthy food. Poisonous food also can come. Because senses also bring food. Mean unhealthy ideas. So what we must do, without worrying about unhealthy ideas or negative aspects, we must constantly focus on the positive. So try to feed your mind with healthy food. So seeing good things, thinking about good things, associating with people whose association will enrich your own spiritual life, give spiritual ideas. They say in the scriptures, it is said, how we judge whether a spiritual idea is healthy or not. Immediately you feel a kind of inner serenity, fulfillment, a peace. That is healthy. If it creates conflicts, it is unhealthy. So our mind is now full of good, healthy, positive, spiritual vrittis and impressions, and also negative ones. Mind is like a bundle, two compartments. One compartment full of positive, healthy, helpful, spiritual impressions. Then the other bag, the other compartment, unhealthy. We need not worry about unhealthy ones. What we must do, focus on the positive. So once the positive impressions get enriched, they get strengthened, and then you feel we get the feeling of inner direction. That's why it is very important. I can quote this one of the classic definitions of spiritual practice is coming in the Vaishnava tradition, and first anugulyesya sankalpaha pradivulyesya vacha means you should constantly contemplate and meditate upon positive, helpful, healthy spiritual ideas. And the rest should be rejected. We should not positively try to reject them. Then we'll come back. It's like, you know, suppose you try not to think of something, they'll be always thinking about it. End of the story. A patient, I recorded earlier, a patient wanted to make fun of an Ayurvedic physician. She was losing his hair. So he wanted to make fun of him. The Ayurvedic doctor told him, you should never think of an egg, the surface of an egg. So from that day onwards, he was struggling not to think of an egg. It means he had to think of it, then he should try not to think of it. You cannot positively try to avoid something without identifying with it. So that's a problem. This is what is in ancient scripture. It's a very interesting classical illustration. So what we must do, we need not worry about negative or the other side. Always go on feeding the mind with positive, healthy, helpful ideas. Forget other thing completely. That's one method. And as we do that, suddenly you find a sense of inner fulfillment. That's the sign of it.
Swamiji, when you were speaking about the gap between
mind and intellect.
Yes, mind and intellect. And you mentioned that those who are identified with the ideation or the concepts sometimes mistake that for actual perception that they've actually experienced.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned that the experience is actually through the mind. Could you elaborate that?
Yes. You know, what really happened, sometimes when we pursue a higher idea, we have a great inclination, we like to identify ourselves with a great, grand, highest, Advaitic or universal idea. And then we want to practice it. There's a sincere effort to practice it. But our mind may not be willing to do that. In the sense, if mind is not willing, then conflicts arise. If there is a conflict, it's always due to the gap between mind and intellect. We feel a kind of jerk, a friction. You can feel in our own life. In a way, this cannot be explained in everyone's life. You can easily see, we take the example of a student studying in primary school. He's studying fifth grade. Suppose he tries, somebody tries to teach him a lesson meant for 10th grade. There'll be a jerk, a conflict. Suppose he studies his lessons very well in the 5th grade. Then later on you teach him the lessons belonging to the 6th grade, there will be no jerk. So if there is a conflict, a friction is due to the gap between the two. But at the same time, there is nothing wrong in keeping the higher ideal in the horizon. Advaita or the highest ideal can be kept as a goal to be achieved on the horizon, but we should always try to reach that level. You know, sometimes those who identify themselves with Advaita, non-dualism, they make fun of devotion, make fun of reading scriptures, make fun of worship and other practices. It's all because they imagine what intellect perceives is a matter of real experience, not. So, Shankaracharya has enumerated sadhana chatushtayam, the four fundamental disciplines that you find in Viveka Chudamani, is really an effort to bridge the gap between intellect and mind. Most of the deviations in spiritual life take place because of this gap. That's why you find in the lives of the greatest Vedantic teachers, Advaitic teachers, who apparently go beyond or transcend the form of worship, you know, with worship God with form, they never disparage, they never belittle devotional practices. They never belittle. Just as a professor teaching in Harvard will not say all the children are learning kindergarten all absolute nonsense. So you don't have to learn the alphabet. No, it's no use. No, higher teaching transcends the lower levels of teaching. This, it doesn't reject or contradict or conflict, not in conflict with the lower levels of teaching. It goes beyond it. Going beyond is totally different from rejecting or contradicting. Okay, now we'll conclude. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Sri Ram Krishna.